Good morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. I think this is the sixth time that I've had the pleasure of speaking at AusPayNet's annual summit, and so it's really great to be back, and particularly great to be back in person. As we all know, the world of payments is changing very rapidly. It's a world of innovation, and as Helen, you reminded us, it's a world of disruption. It's a world of changing business models and of investment that has the potential to reshape our financial systems. So the world of payments is a very exciting place at the moment. The Reserve Bank has a broad mandate to help shape this changing world in a way that works for the best interests of Australians, Australian households and Australian businesses. We do this through a combination of suasion, of regulation, and working with the industry to try and overcome some of the coordination problems that can bedevil payment systems. The Reserve Bank also directly supports innovation where we reasonably can, and we're working with the government to help modernise the regulatory framework for payments in Australia. So I know you're all very busy, but we're busy at the bank as well. I think, as we all know, Australians expect payments to be fast, secure, safe, reliable, and easy to use. And at the RBA, we share these expectations. We want to see a payment system that's competitive, that's safe to use, that's dynamic and competitive, and that's serving the needs of all Australians. This morning, I would like to highlight four issues that we're working through in pursuit of these objectives. The first is to lower the costs that merchants pay for payment services. The second is to support the development of Australia's fast payment system. The third is to lower the cost and increase the speed of international payments. And the fourth is to support the innovation that's necessary to make sure that Australia is well placed for the digital economy. So first, to merchant costs. This has been an area of focus for the Reserve Bank for many years, and this is one area where progress has been made, significant progress. And I'm hoping you can see this in my first chart here. In the mid-2000s, merchants paid an average of 1.4% on MasterCard and Visa transactions. Today, they pay 0.7%, so the costs have fallen in half. And as you can see, the costs of accepting other card payments have also fallen. This big reduction in merchant costs followed the Reserve Bank stepping in and regulating interchange fees and giving merchants the choice as to whether or not they recover the cost of the payments they accept. While surcharging isn't popular with consumers, I know that. While it's not popular, it has resulted in pressure on card schemes to lower their fees, and this has resulted in lower costs for merchants. Another important influence on merchant costs is the mix of payments they accept. There are large differences in the cost of accepting various types of payments. I hope you can see that here. Over the past decade, there has been a shift away from high-cost credit cards to lower-cost debit cards, and that's evident in the right-hand side of this graph. The RBA's interchange regulation played a role here too. The reduction in interchange fees reduced the attractiveness of credit cards because the reward points were lowered, and in response to this shift in the relative attractiveness, some people have shifted to debit, and this has helped to lower merchant costs. The other big shift in the mix of payments is the declining use of cash. This shift away from cash accelerated during the pandemic, and it's evident in the sharp decline in the value of cash withdrawals through ATMs. The value of cash withdrawals through ATMs is down by 17% over the past 3 years, down by 17%. At the same time, the value of nominal spending in the economy is up by 27%. So there's a clear shift away from the use of cash for payments. Despite this, there is still strong demand for banknotes as a store of value. As you can see in this next chart, there are 38 $50 banknotes on issue for every single Australian. And to my surprise, there are 18 $100 notes. on issue for every Australian. I don't have my share. I don't know whether many people in this room do. I think most of them are sitting in cupboards and under mattresses. So while cash is not being used for transactions in stores, people are still holding a lot of banknotes. While it's pleasing to see the decline in payment costs for merchants, there are three developments that are working in the other direction. The first is the shift to the higher cost international schemes and away from FPOS. The second is the shift to online commerce, where merchants typically face higher payment costs. And the third is the greater use of mobile wallets offered by Apple Pay, Google Pay and Samsung Pay. As you can see in this chart, the use of these wallets is growing very rapidly. They're more expensive for merchants typically, and I expect this growth to continue and the cost of accepting payments through these wallets to become an increasingly important issue. I'd also like to highlight the fact that there are very large differences in the payments costs incurred by small and by large businesses. As you can see in this chart, small businesses on average pay twice what large businesses pay to process the same transaction. It's a big difference. While economies of scale explain part of this difference, economies of scale aren't the full story here. There are other factors at play. Given these various developments, the RBA's focus is on increasing competition to help further drive down payment costs in Australia. This is where giving merchants choice over which payment network to use is particularly important. It's the so-called least cost routing. It's a significant priority for the Reserve, for the Payment System Board at the Reserve Bank. We want to see greater use of least cost routing. Least cost routing allows merchants to choose the lowest cost card network to process their debit card transactions. It also increases the competitive pressure between the debit networks. It provides greater incentives to lower wholesale fees. Ultimately, that leads to lower merchant costs and ultimately lower costs for consumers. It's particularly important for small businesses that typically can't negotiate discounted fees with the card schemes. For in-store transactions, least cost routing is now available in around 85% of merchants, although only around half of merchants are actually using least cost routing at the moment. This low take-up suggests that the industry has more work to do to promote the benefits of least cost routing to the merchants, and we encourage the industry to do that work. Some financial institutions also have more work to do to complete their rollout, and they have not met the expected timetable. To provide greater transparency on how individual institutions are progressing, the RBA will next year start publishing institution-level detail on least cost routing availability and take-up. In terms of online payments, the Payment System Board expects that least cost routing will be available by the end of this year. Overall, the industry is largely on track to meet that deadline. While some providers are running a bit behind schedule, most have said to us that least cost routing for online transactions will be up and running in the first half of 2023. As for in-person transactions, the RBA will give public visibility to how individual institutions are performing. It's important that when institutions make commitments, they meet those commitments. The next frontier for least cost routing is in-store mobile wallet transactions. Over recent months, the RBA has been consulting with the major mobile wallet providers, issuers, acquirers and terminal providers. On the basis of this consultation, the Payment System Board has formed the view that it would be both feasible and desirable for the industry to deliver least cost routing functionality for mobile wallet transactions by the end of 2024. And the next step here is for the mobile wallet providers to finalise their plans and to share those plans with the industry so that the necessary investments in the payment ecosystem can get underway. Overall, we're optimistic that least cost routing will help counter the forces that are adding to merchant payment costs, particularly for small businesses where the costs are highest. Looking ahead, other regulatory and market developments are expected to increase competition and to maintain the downward pressure on merchant costs. modernisation of the Payment System Regulation Act as proposed by the Farrell Review would open up the possibility of the Reserve Bank regulating newer entities in the payments ecosystem, and we expect this will help promote competition and efficiency. Greater transparency of merchant costs through the expansion of the consumer data right can also help increase competition, and new payment methods are likely to emerge over time to compete with card payments, including possibly the use of QR codes for account-to-account payments at retailers. So there's a lot of innovation, a lot of disruption, and our hope and expectation is the end result of this will be lower payment costs for merchants, and lower payment costs for merchants ultimately mean lower costs for consumers. The second broad issue that I wanted to talk about was the need to continue to build on the architecture of Australia's fast payment system, the NPP. The NPP is now available to customers at more than 110 financial institutions, and it's used to make around a quarter of all account-to-account payments. Over the past year, the NPP has processed over a billion transactions worth more than $1 trillion, and its usage continues to grow rapidly. Because you can see in this next chart, the take-up by Australians of the fast payment system compares favourably with similar systems in other advanced economies, and I expect to see this take-up continue to grow. The use of PayIDs has also grown. PayIDs are a simple way of addressing payments, for example, through a registered mobile number, an email address or a business number. Almost 13 million PayIDs have been registered, and PayIDs are used to initiate around a fifth of NPP payments. Apart from being convenient, PayIDs provide a safer way to make payments. When a payment's addressed using a PayID, as you know, the payer is shown the name of the person or the business they're paying the money to, and you're asked to confirm that before you make the payment. This does help reduce the chance of scams, and it does reduce the chance of mistakenly making payments to the wrong person. I think a recent survey commissioned by NPP Australia showed that one in four PayID users had stopped or edited a PayID payment where they had noticed that the recipient's details weren't quite right. I think that's good news that people are doing that, but we are not yet realising the full benefits of this system. I think financial institutions have more work to do in promoting awareness and the adoption of PayIDs and the extra security that comes from the use of this part of our system. And I really encourage financial institutions to talk to their customers about the benefits of using a PayID. More generally, the NPP has been constrained to date by the fact that it catered for push payments only. PayID, which was launched Pay2, which was launched in June this year, is set to change this. Pay2 will modernise the way we make direct debits, giving customers greater control over payments authorised to come out of their accounts. It's also expected to support a wave of innovation, including from fintechs. But only one major bank has met the previously agreed timetable for the development of the Pay2 payer system. The reasons for the delays are complex, but slow progress by the major banks imposes a cost on the rest of the industry, and this cost is of a concern to us. We know that investments have had to be put on hold by others because of the slow progress by the major banks. Successful uptake of the system requires most financial institutions to be offering the service, and the fact that some are running behind has meant that the innovators have incurred additional costs and had to slow down. So this is another area where the major banks have slipped behind what they said they would do. The new agreed timeline is to complete the necessary work by April 23, and the RBA expects this timetable to be met. The third broad issue that I wanted to address was the cost and speed of cross-border payments. The G20 economies have committed to making sure that cross-border payments are faster and cheaper, more transparent and more accessible. And Australia needs to play its role here, and the cost of international payments from Australia is still too high. It's a particular problem for our neighbours in the South Pacific, where too often people on low incomes face very high charges for making relatively small payments to their family back at home. Progress has been made in this area, but it's slow. In part, the progress is coming about because of increased competition. We've seen a number of cheaper digital non-bank operators enter the market, and this has pushed prices down. There's also been an improvement in transparency through improved online calculators following initiatives from the ACCC. In addition, we welcome the fact that some of Australia's largest banks are now waiving fees on some transactions for the South Pacific corridor, so that's a positive development. There is, though, a lot more to be done here, and we need the assistance of Australia's financial institutions to make further progress. It's important we do this as a country. One current issue is the speed of cross-border payments. According to data from SWIFT, more than 80% of the time taken for cross-border payment to reach an Australian recipient is due to the final Australian dollar leg of the payment. 80% is due to what happens domestically. A number of other comparable countries process incoming payments much more quickly than we do, including some in our time zone. So it's another area we need to do better. The delivery of the NPP International Payments Business Service, I think, will help make progress here. The service will allow the final Australian dollar leg of inbound cross-border payments to be processed through the NPP. And because the NPP offers real-time processing on a 24/7 basis, this will speed up payment times. The industry committed to delivering the new service by the 1st of December 2023 in the NPP roadmap that was released this month. Again, we expect this deadline to be met by all banks participating in the NPP. Delays here by the large banks will hurt Australian consumers, and they will hold back Australia's progress in meeting our international commitments that we've made through the G20. A related development is the adoption of the new messaging format, which will replace the SWIFT messaging format. In time, this richer, internationally harmonised messaging system will lower costs and will help speed up payment times. It's also possible that over time, various countries' fast payment systems will come to be linked up. Last year, Singapore and Thailand linked up their systems, and this has reduced costs to consumers in those countries. And we know a number of similar projects are under discussion elsewhere in the world. As part of the exploration of linking up fast payment systems, the BIS Innovation Hub has been developing a bridging platform for the connection of fast payment systems in the region and around the world. We're engaged in this work, and I sit on the advisory board of the BIS Innovation Hub. Whether or not this is going to be the best solution for linking up our fast payment systems is yet to be determined, but the direction of change here is clear. Next year, the RBA is planning to work with the Australian industry to study the economic, business and technical issues involved in linking up fast payment systems around the world. It's just really a matter of time when this will happen. I'm confident that these fast payment systems will be linked up, so that should be on our radar screen. The final issue that I want to talk about is our work supporting innovation to help Australia be well placed for the digital economy. Some of the issues that I've already touched on will help here, but I'd like to mention two others. The RBA's work exploring a central bank digital currency and the work underway to modernise Australia's regulatory architecture. My colleague Brad Jones spoke last week about some of the issues that we're working through when it comes to the possibility of a central bank digital currency for retail purposes. We have an open mind as to whether a public policy case will emerge to go in this direction. However, as things currently stand, that public policy case has not yet been established. We are, though, exploring the possibilities and some of the technical issues and business issues in case that assessment changes. But as we currently stand, we're not able to conclude that there's a public policy case for us to issue a central bank digital currency for retail purposes. But we are exploring the issues. As part of this exploration, we have embarked on a project with the Digital Finance Cooperative Research Centre involving the issue of a pilot central bank digital currency that has real value and it's operating in a closed, ring-fenced environment. We've invited industry participants to propose use cases, and there's been an overwhelming demand for people to experiment in this test environment. We're also looking at potential use cases for a wholesale central bank digital currency, and that could complement our exchange settlement accounts that the Reserve Bank currently operates. We're testing in the pilot project, is about to start early in the year, and I'm hoping by mid-year we'll be able to share the results of that with you. We're also looking at the pros and cons of an alternative form of a digital Australian dollar. That's a payment stable coin that's issued by the private sector, just as banks currently issue bank deposits. If we were to go in this direction, the payment stable coins would need to be backed by a very strong regulatory regime, just as a strong regulatory regime applies to deposits today. So that's an alternative to a central bank digital currency. We could have privately issued and well-regulated stable coins. And we have an open mind as to whether that's going to be a better model than the Reserve Bank issuing these coins. The RBA is also working with the Australian Government to make sure the regulatory architecture is fit for purpose, and the bank very much welcomes today the release of the consultation paper on the strategic plan and the government signalling its intention to move forward with a number of issues at modernising Australia's payment system. From our perspective, one priority reform is the establishment of a new licensing regime for payment service providers. This would help overcome some of the challenges faced by these providers when they're entering the Australian market, and many of them have spoken to us about the challenges they face. The bank is also working on a set of common access requirements for new payment service providers so that they can more easily enter the market. Our aim here is to ensure a level playing field so that people with new ideas, particularly the fintechs, can come in and can compete with the existing banks offering better, hopefully cheaper, and more secure payment services for Australians. A second priority for us is the development of regulatory arrangements for payment stablecoins. As I mentioned a moment ago, we can envisage a world where payment stablecoins are issued by banks and others, just as banks issue deposits, and that these payment stablecoins are used to make payments. But if we are to go in that direction as a country, these payment stable coins will need to be well regulated, and a regulatory architecture will need to be developed for them. In many ways, the regulatory issues here are similar to stored value cards, such as prepaid travel cards and digital wallet services, and we've already done some work, which is going to be a good starting point to think about payment stable coins. A third priority for us in the regulatory front is the modernisation of the Payment System Regulation Act. A lot's changed here since the Act was put in place more than 20 years ago. The payment system is much more complex. There are many new business models, and technology shifted a lot in the 20 plus years since that's been put in place. The changes that were proposed by the Federal Review and now supported by the government, I think, will help the Reserve Bank shape this evolution of Australia's payment system in the public interest. As I said at the start, the payments world is changing rapidly, and we all have a lot to do. Some of the items on our to-do list are for immediate attention. The deadlines need to be met, so there are some issues for immediate attention. But some issues on the to-do list are less well-defined. We're still uncertain about what the ultimate structure of our payment system will be in 10 years' time. So some of the issues on the to-do list are not well-defined, but we need to keep working on them, and we need to keep exploring the options and be prepared for what comes down the line. AusPayNet is a very valuable partner for the Reserve Bank as we undertake this journey, and AusPayNet plays a really important role in the governance of Australia's payment system. So the Reserve Bank looks forward to continuing our constructive and productive relationship with AusPayNet as we both together navigate this changing world in the interests of the Australian people and delivering fast, secure, cheap payment systems for Australian households and businesses. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer some questions.
Governor Lowe, thank you so much. That was very meaty. I think we could do with another round of applause for the Governor, please. There's so much in that for a normal consumer like myself. I know the room is much more knowledgeable about all these things, so I will certainly not fill it with my questions. But I do look forward to being offered pay two by my bank. So it's no surprise that I haven't been offered yet. That should be working.
Well, if you haven't been offered it, go and ask them why.
All right.
And go and switch banks to someone who will offer you the service, because it's a much better way to make payments. You can be sure you're not going to make a payment to the wrong person by typing in a wrong account number or BSB.
Yes.
Which we all do every now and then, and it's a pain, isn't it?
So yes.
If you use a pay ID, it's not going to happen.
All right. First question from one of our questioners. Oh, it's actually from Andy. Well, I'll let you get in first, Andy White, who's the CEO. Should the surcharging of debit card transactions continue?
Well, it's really a choice of the merchants. And the whole idea is to allow the merchants to make a choice about whether they surcharge their customers. And by having that right, it affects how they then negotiate with the banks and the card schemes. So it puts pressure on payment costs. If the merchants don't want to surcharge, they don't have to. But if they think it's in their advantage and they can lower their costs in doing it, then they should have the right to do that.
Okay, but there's nothing that riles consumers more than that, is there?
Oh, I know. As I said, consumers don't like surcharging, so the merchant has to take that into account. But we know that the ability to surcharge puts downward pressure on the fees that the banks and the card schemes charge. And consumers, in the end, benefit from that. They don't see it, so it's hard to kind of acknowledge that. But what they see is the surcharge. But we know that this does put downward pressure on costs.
Yeah.
So we want merchants to have that choice.
Sandra has asked, when will NPP be a mandated payment channel? We have a payroll of over 180,000 staff and cannot use NPP as the recipient banks are not all enabled.
That's a kind of a surprise to me that would be the case. All the banks tell us they're enabled, so kind of perhaps, again, be good to go to their bank and ask them why.
Yeah. And could they be smaller credit unions?
They could be. I don't know. Most institutions in Australia can now make and receive NPP payments, so I don't know what the specifics of this case are, but
all
it's
right, Sandra, you have to go back to all those banks that you send out your payroll to. David asks, how might industry assist with influencing Australians to relinquish their physical cash held in cupboards and under mattresses? And is that a real thing? I know you said it is, but is it a very big portion of the cash?
It is. I think, as best we can tell, perhaps three-quarters of the banknotes on issue are not being used for day-to-day transactions. They're being used as a store of value. 18 $100 bills on issue for every single person in the country. And yet...
Haven't the crooks got most of those?
No, people are using them as a store of value at home. And we know this partly because when there are floods or bushfires, people's notes either get burnt or soiled in the water, and you can bring your burnt notes into the Reserve Bank, and our scientists can tell you what value was there and will give you value for it. So we know after the bushfires that people come in with blobs of molten polymer, and it was in their under their bed. Or what we know is if there's competition, then fees come down, and so the regulators around the world are looking at this issue and whether there's a possibility of multiple digital wallets sitting on the iPhones. And if you want to encourage competition, there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there?
Yeah, but it is interesting. Most of us, you know, a lot of us have iPhones. Yeah. I do. And you feel like you cannot escape what they're the only ones offering you that. And it feels very insidious that they're saying, well, you have to use our wallet. Well, how do I know whether it's safe, blah, 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 et cetera? And it's maybe a cost as well.
Well, there is a cost. There are costs to the banks when their customers use the Apple Wallet. So what we would like to see over time and what regulators in other countries are pushing for is competition.
But I know you've talked a lot about the big tech players coming into this space. How do you force them to allow competition?
Well, we are, we've been asking the government for some time, and the Farrell Review recommended this, that the underlying legislation the Reserve Bank operates under be modified to allow us to regulate a wider range of participants in the payments ecosystem. And this is obviously, if we get these powers, this will be one issue that we'll be looking at very carefully, because, as you say, more and more of us are using our mobile phones to make payments, and that's the way of the future, and we need to have the regulatory regime to deal with that.
Yeah.
But it's on our radar screen, definitely.
Trevor asks, do you have views on how we can remove all checks from the payment system? Well, Trevor, I know people who still write checks and they couldn't sort of support their charities and that sort of thing without writing a check, as old-fashioned as that seems. But here, Trevor wants to get rid of them all. So what are your views on that?
Well, at some point down the road, I think that will happen. Mm. But the question is how quickly we get there. We've got two focus areas at the moment. The first is working with the government for the government to reduce its own use of checks.
Ah.
Remember how you always used to get these Medicare checks when you go to the doctor?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's either ending or has ended, I'm not sure. But so the government has been a big user of checks, so we're trying to get the government to use less checks, and there's a lot of progress there. And the other strategy is to use the NPP and other payment solutions to offer alternatives to people. So the people that you were talking about who currently say they can't live without checks, we've got to offer them another solution. In some countries, people don't use checks. They don't have checks, and they're still, charities still get money.
Yeah.
So there are other solutions.
I know, it's just educating people, isn't it?
Well, it's educating, but we've got to have the solutions as well.
Yeah.
I would hope that perhaps some of the people in this room are thinking of innovative ways of replacing checks for people who currently think they need them to live.
Yeah, because at the other end, younger people don't necessarily know what checks are. So if they're working in the banks and they receive a check...
I saw one of my kids got a check from his grandmother recently for a birthday and couldn't believe that this was money. I had to explain to him, he had to go to the bank, but it is. Why would you want to... Why didn't you just pay ID me?
What's that, she said. One final question perhaps from Rajat. With consumers generally unwilling to pay for payments, how can providers keep investing in payments initiatives and get viable return on investment? Your view on that?
Well, I mean, some consumers do pay for payments, and merchants pay for payments as well. As the graph that I showed, at the moment, merchants are paying 0.7% of the value of their turnover if a Visa or MasterCard is presented. So people are paying, and that generates a substantial stream of revenue to finance innovation. So I think that, no one likes to pay for anything, do we? But we know we have to pay, and there's substantial charges levied on both consumers and merchants, and that's financing investment. And you've got institutions have to keep investing to be competitive, because look how many people in this room, they're all, many of them, I hope, everyone here is thinking of new innovations to get consumers to offer better services and more secure services. So that's the market at work. And the number of people in this room suggests it's a very vibrant market, doesn't it? No lack of innovation in payments.
Governor, there is a question that has been swirling around outside this room, and I wondered if you wanted to make a comment. This is the place where you are, it's the only place really where you get to comment on your future, and hopefully you'll be back here next year at the conference talking to us.
Well, I don't know, that's a matter for the government. My term finishes in September next year. I've got an important job to do, at least up until then, and I intend to do it, and whether I can join you for a seventh time is not in my control. I hope so, but we'll see.
But you'll be there for the next several months.
Certainly, I know there have been calls for me to resign. As I said before, I have no intention of resigning. I have an important job to do. It's a responsible job, and I intend to do it. We've got to get inflation down, and that's my focus, and I will keep doing that at least until mid-September next year.
Would you please thank Governor Philip Lowe for his keynote? Thank you so much. Do you want to put that microphone there? And then if you'd like to go off there, Philip.